there was language used to mischaracterize the nature of the remedies. School desegregation became not constitutional issues, they were busing cases. Affirmative action were no longer characterized as dealing with goals and timetables as a means of measuring the progress we had made in changing from a segregated workforce or a segregated educational institution to one that was using quotas. And even though we in the civil rights community that I was involved in at that time had accepted the proposition that quotas were unacceptable and were unconstitutional, and we were not engaging in quotas, we had flexible goals and timetables. So there was that there was a mischaracterization, I think, which led to the unraveling of a great deal of the remedies that we had achieved.
Judge Jones, Commissioner Kirsinos made a point that sounded to me like a pretty interesting one. He said, look, young John Roberts thought that wrote on behalf of the Reagan administration that the voting rights law didn't need to be strengthened. But then Congress strengthened it. And when he was the Deputy Solicitor General, he signed briefs and argued cases supporting that extension, aggressively supporting that extension. So doesn't that really belie some of the worries about him?
Well, those are the matters that the committee will have to take into under consideration. You have, on the one hand, the torrent of memoranda, the virtually anti-civil rights remedial assault that was coming out of the Justice Department, out of the White House. You have the examples that you've just referred to. What weight should be given to those instances where he participated as a lawyer and advancing interests of some parties in affirmative action cases? That's up to the committee. The committee is the judge here. It has to balance these modern or more recent actions with that long history. Being the judge in this case, or the jury, the committee will have to make a judgment. My call here in testifying is to remind the committee of history, and that we cannot avoid history and act as though this past never occurred.
I have just one quick question. Why would he? Nobody seems to think that Judge Roberts harbors racial malice. So why would he have been deliberately undermining the Voting Rights Act? He thought that this was a legitimate legal position that the administration was taking, and that he was writing memos on orders to support.
Well, I'd go back further than that. I recall when President Reagan kicked off his campaign for governor in 1980 down in Philadelphia, Mississippi, he declared, and he repeated several times, that he was going to bring about a sea change in the makeup of the federal courts, that he was going to eliminate what we call activist judges and appoint only judges who would interpret the law and not legislate from the bench. And then to carry that forward, there were these strategies that came out of the White House, came out of the Justice Department, that challenged settled principles of law. This didn't mean that those who were developing these strategies were venal or racist. These were, I think, driven more as much by ideology and by politics as by anything else.
Judge Jones, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate
your
time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Nathaniel Jones, retired as a U.S. From the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in the Sixth Circuit, and previous to that, he worked for the NAACP in the job that Thurgood Marshall once held, and we appreciate him joining us today. We're still waiting for the Senate Judiciary Committee to return from a lunch break, and it's possible that they have also run into one of those votes that we've been anticipating all day on the Senate floor. The witnesses who are scheduled to testify in this third panel this afternoon are already arrayed at the table. None of the senators have yet returned to the room, and Nina Totenberg, I thought it was Interesting, you were talking earlier today about Maureen Mahoney, who's scheduled to lead off the witnesses in this third panel. When the room was virtually empty and virtually dark, 2 minutes to two, she was there ready to go.
Yeah, I forgot to mention she was also a clerk to Chief Justice Rehnquist. So we have an almost identical profile, in a way, to the John Roberts profile.
Tom Goldstein is here.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Even to the point of having been nominated for a judge in the first Bush administration and not having made it through the Senate.
Right, because it was there was a at some point the Democrats who were then in control cut off the consideration. It was towards the very near the election, and so the Roberts nomination didn't go through, the Mahoney nomination didn't go through, and neither did a bunch of others. But Maureen Mahoney served as law clerk to Chief Justice Rehnquist, as Deputy Solicitor General in the first Bush administration, and is a lawyer at a large corporate law firm representing a lot of big corporate interests. She won a huge case in the Supreme Court this last term, a unanimous opinion on behalf of Arthur Anderson, which had been convicted on criminal charges in connection to the Enron case, and the Supreme Court unanimously, at her behest, struck down the conviction as wholly unconstitutional, not authorized by law, I guess I should say, to be more precise, not authorized by the federal criminal law. And so it was a huge victory for her. And, of course, she also argued the affirmative action case on behalf of the University of Michigan and won.
That would have been the University of Michigan Law School.
The University of Michigan Law School. And there was this wonderful moment in that argument where she was up there fending off a question a minute from a variety of justices. And Chief Justice Rehnquist said, "But Maureen, don't you think?" And he didn't even realize he'd called her by her first name. And she didn't seem to realize he'd called her by her first name. She just kept going.
Chief Justice Rehnquist, a very close relationship with many of his clerks and former clerks. I think there was a scene that was described in the Washington Post talking about the relationship that he had with his previous Chief Justice, Warren Burger. They described a scene in the Supreme Court of then Associate Justice Rehnquist and his clerks gathered on the second floor, gazing down at watching Chief Justice Burger rearrange the silverware set for an event and laughing.
Yeah, that's right. And all of those clerks were gathered for the funeral last week. Was it last week? Yes, it was last week.
Just last week, yes.
Yes, it feels like it was a longer time ago than that. But it was just last week, and there were dozens and dozens of law clerks. I think in total the chief had close to 200 clerks in the course of his tenure on the court, 165, 170 clerks. And there were lots and lots of them there. And at each event, when the coffin was brought to lie in repose in the Great Hall at the Supreme Court, there were eight clerks or six clerks, I can't remember which, carrying the coffin. And you could see John Roberts actually helped carry the coffin in. A different set of clerks carried the coffin for the funeral. Mm-hmm. But you could see that coffin was really heavy. You could see his neck straining. And one of the other clerks said to me at the funeral, "Could you see yesterday how hard it was to bring that coffin in?" And I said, "Yes, you could see." Although everybody was... Because these are all people that are not old. If we were talking about a set of clerks who were a lot older, they would be honorary pallbearers, but these were the real thing.
Let's take a look at some of the other people scheduled to testify in this third panel. Maureen Mahoney will be followed by Carol Browner, who was administrator of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency back in the Clinton administration. Then Catherine Webb Bradley, a senior lecturing fellow at Duke Law School. Anne Marie Tallman, President and General Counsel of the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund. The Honorable Denise Lindbergh, Judge of the Third District of the Utah State Court, in from Salt Lake City. And Reginald Turner Jr., President of the National Bar Association in Detroit, Michigan. And again, these panels will be addressing Judge Roberts' his virtues and his flaws on any number of subjects. And Senator Spector has returned to the chair, and we should be getting underway shortly. There are no Democrats as yet in evidence.
You got to have one of those.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen.
Or maybe not.
Maybe not.
Chairman Spector.
Confirmation hearing on Judge Roberts. We have a distinguished panel, and our first witness is Ms. Maureen Mahoney, a partner in the Washington firm of Latham and Watkins. She had worked with Judge Roberts in the Deputy Solicitor General's office. She had been nominated for a district court judgeship, but with some others, her nomination was not taken up, a problem we intend to correct. She successfully represented the University of Michigan in the Grutter case, and she served as law clerk to Associate Justice Rehnquist and Seventh Circuit Judge Robert Sprecher. Thank you for joining us, Ms. Mahoney, and we look forward to your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. It is a real honor to be here today. Over the past few days, I think all of you and really all of America has gotten to see why so many of us think that Judge Roberts is probably the finest lawyer of our generation. His study of the law, his understanding of the law, is absolutely masterful, and he certainly has the legal skills required to be a superb Chief Justice. Some have nevertheless raised some concerns that he may come to the court committed to implement a partisan agenda and that he may not be fair-minded. I'd really like to speak to those concerns based on my personal experiences with him. As you indicated, I met him in 1980 after he succeeded me as a clerk to the Chief Justice, then Associate Justice Rehnquist. Since that time, I had the opportunity to be his colleague in the Solicitor General's office. I also was a fellow appellate advocate in the private bar and really also a friend. This has given me very, very wonderful opportunity to take the measure of this man, and I cannot think of anyone who would be a finer Chief Justice. I'd like to make three basic observations to respond to some of these issues. And the first is that in the Solicitor General's office, when I worked with him there, he was not viewed as a partisan operative. Instead, he was viewed as a brilliant advocate in the finest tradition of the office. And in fact, in 2001, this office included lawyers from all across the political spectrum. They weren't just Republicans or Democrats, and they all admired him. And in 2001, they sent a letter to this committee to confirm that despite their diverse political parties and persuasions, quote, Mr. Roberts was attentive to and respectful of all views, and he represented the United States zealously but fairly. He had the deepest respect for legal principles and legal precedent, end quote. This from his colleagues. He was not a highly partisan person in that role. The second thing I'd like to say to the committee is please do not presume that the views that are expressed in briefs on behalf of the United States that he filed in the Solicitor General's office necessarily reflect the views that he will adopt as a justice on the Supreme Court. I was a deputy there, too. It was not our job to establish administration policy with respect to immigration, abortion, affirmative action, you name it. Our job was to defend the policies of the administration within the bounds of the law, within the realm of good logic, good reasoning. That was our job. And, in fact, an historical example might be useful on this. Thurgood Marshall served as a Solicitor General of the United States, and while Solicitor General, he filed a brief on behalf of the United States advocating against the rule adopted in Miranda because he said it wasn't good for law enforcement. When he became a Supreme Court Justice, he dissented in cases that refused to extend Miranda more broadly. He abandoned the views that he had previously expressed in a brief because they weren't his views. They were the views of the United States. And I fully expect that Judge Roberts also knows the differences in these roles in our legal system. Third, I have been particularly troubled about suggestions in the media that he may harbor bias against women. And I say this because I know firsthand that he was very interested in promoting equal opportunity for women. He actually recruited me to the office of Solicitor General in 1991. There was a vacancy for the deputy slot. There are only four deputies in the office at any given time. This is a highly coveted position. And he called me. He encouraged me to come and apply for that job. He supported me. I got the job and, as a result, was one of the very few women in history to serve in that position. A year later, a vacancy came open on the Eastern District of Virginia, the federal court, and he again encouraged me to apply. He helped shepherd me through that nomination process. And as you indicated, for some reason, the committee forgot to get me confirmed. But these were things that Judge Roberts did, not just for me, but for other women who all admire and respect him and have absolutely no doubt that he harbors no bias. In sum, I think that he is particularly well-suited to succeed the Chief Justice. They both share some incredible traits, really exquisite intelligence, an abiding sense of modesty, charming wit. And I think that the Chief, above all, understood that the role of a judge is to serve, not to rule. And I think that there's no question that Judge Roberts learned that lesson well, and he ought to be confirmed as the next Chief Justice. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Mahoney, demonstrating your skills as an appellate advocate, ending precisely on time.
I was worrying about that.
Jeremy is 1 second over. I was watching.
Precisely on time. Our next witness is the Honorable Carol Browner, former distinguished administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. She used to be a member of the Senate family when she served as legislative director to Senator Albert Gore when he was here. A graduate of the University of Florida, both undergrad and law school, and currently is a member of the Albright Group. Thank you for joining us, Ms. Browner, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to appear here today, and I ask that my full statement be placed in the record.
Without objection, your statement will be made a part of the record, as will all statements.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, as you just noted, I have spent most of my professional life involved in our country's efforts to protect the air we breathe, the water we drink, the health of our communities, the health of our children. Our environmental laws and regulations have allowed us to make steady progress in this country toward cleaner air, cleaner water, a healthy environment. While it is not always a perfect system, a dismantling of this system could leave our country without any sensible way to address ongoing environmental problems such as mercury, the disappearance of our wetlands, and the reality of global warming. Briefly, I want to speak to three issues: the Commerce Clause, the power of Congress to delegate to the executive branch, and citizen standing. More than 40 years ago, Congress realized that individual states often lack the power or the will to do the job of lessening and reducing pollution. Congress recognized that pollution doesn't stop at political boundaries. Dirty air blows across the country without regard for where it originates, and polluted water inevitably flows downstream. Relying on its Commerce Clause authority, Congress passed a whole body of environmental legislation. The Supreme Court's decisions in Lopez and Morrison have triggered an effort to undermine Congress's use of its Commerce Clause authority in a number of environmental statutes, including the Clean Water Act. In the Swank decision, a case involving wetlands, the petitioners argued that Congress lacked the authority under the Commerce Clause to protect isolated wetlands. Well, as we have all been recently reminded with Katrina, wetlands are a very important part of nature's efforts to protect us from flooding, to cleanse our waters, to provide important habitat. While the court avoided ruling on the Commerce Clause challenge in Swank, it is troubling that the majority did note, quote, significant constitutional questions regarding the authority of Congress to protect certain types of wetlands, even those used by migratory birds. I want to quote from Justice Kennedy. Although he joined with the majority, he noted in Lopez, "The court as an institution and the legal system as a whole have an immense stake in the stability of our Commerce Clause jurisprudence as it has evolved to this point." While Judge Roberts' dissenting opinion from denial of rehearing in Viejo, the case that we is now referred to as the hapless toad case, is not definitive as to his position on the Commerce Clause, it is certainly worth noting that a three-judge panel had rejected a Commerce Clause argument that the Endangered Species, with respect to the Endangered Species Act. Lower court judges have also attempted to restrict the authority of Congress to delegate certain powers to the executive branch. In a case I was personally involved with about my decision to set clean air, air pollution standards for ozone and smog, the lower court struck down a key section of the Clean Air Act as unconstitutional, citing the non-delegation doctrine, which had been rejected by courts for more than 50 years. For decades, Congress has asked EPA, told EPA to do this job, to do it based on the best available science, to do it to protect the public's health. These are sort of fundamental principles embedded in many of our environmental statutes that have allowed us to make the kind of progress that we have made to date. Finally, Congress has frequently recognized the right of individual citizens to seek enforcement of our country's environmental laws. When I was the head of the EPA, I was frequently asked, well, wouldn't you like Congress to prevent those lawsuits from being sued against you, those lawsuits from being filed against you, those lawsuits from being filed against your agency? And my answer was always no. Citizen suits are an essential part of how we have gone about this work of clean air and clean water. If Congress tells an agency, the executive branch, to do something and they fail to do it, the citizens of this country should have the right to go to our courts and see that Congress's laws are upheld. A key role and responsibility of government is to protect those things we all hold in common, our air, our water, the public health of our communities. The nation's environmental laws are based on a set of shared values, and they rest on principles embraced by Congress over many, many years. The High Court should respect the broad authority of Congress under the Constitution and well-established precedents that allow for a robust federal role in protecting our environment. The Court should continue to recognize the right of Congress to delegate to the executive branch the day-to-day work to set pollution standards, to enforce those standards, and the court must ensure the opportunity for individual citizens to step in when the executive branch fails to do what Congress has directed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Browner. Our next witness is Professor Catherine Webb Bradley, Senior Lecturing Fellow at the Duke University School of Law, graduate of Wake Forest and the University of Maryland, first in her class, clerk for Justice White. Later became a litigator at Hogan and Hartso. We thank you very much for coming in today, Ms. Professor Bradley, and look forward to your testimony.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to be here today. I've been a Democrat since I was old enough to vote. But while the President has not enjoyed my personal support, his nominee has my full and enthusiastic support today. I've known John Roberts since 1990, when I was privileged to serve as law clerk to Justice Byron White. As a law clerk, I watched then-Deputy Solicitor General Roberts argue several cases before the court. While I was fortunate to see many talented advocates that year, John Roberts stood out in my mind as simply the best. What made him so effective was his gift for being able to take extraordinarily complex concepts and then explain them in a way that seemed straightforward, even simple, yet never simplistic. His command of the facts and his law of the case was impressive, not just because of the level of preparation it revealed, but because it enabled him to anticipate and respond to the concerns of the court about whatever position he was advocating. Inevitably, his colloquy with the court left the impression that he'd blazed for the court a clear trail that it could comfortably follow to reach the result he sought. That's not to say that he was successful in every case, but I do believe that in each case, his advocacy aided the court in its decision-making process, which is precisely what good advocacy should do. My admiration for his advocacy skills deepened to a deep respect for his intellect and his integrity during the time we were colleagues at Hogan and Hartson, where I worked with him on a number of appellate and administrative matters. What I remember most clearly, though, are not the details of the cases in which I assisted him, but about the times when his guidance proved invaluable to me. I have time for one of those stories today. I was a senior associate involved in the defense of a state institution in a suit brought under the Fair Labor Standards Act. The plaintiff had initially filed suit in federal court, but dismissed the complaint and refiled in state court after the Supreme Court issued its decision in Seminole Tribe v. Florida. As I began to look at the issues, I wondered whether we might move to dismiss the state suit on constitutional sovereign immunity grounds similar to those that had mandated dismissal of the federal suit. But the only helpful legal authority were a few state trial court cases and one or two articles. So I called John Roberts and I ran the argument by him. His response was that while I had a colorable legal argument, the theory I was suggesting certainly did not fit within his understanding of the court's interpretation of the 11th Amendment. We proceeded to file the motion, and when we lost the motion, we filed an appeal. And at each stage, even though he was not directly involved in the case, John was supportive and responsive to my questions. And when our appeal was stayed, pending the Supreme Court's consideration of Alden v. Maine, which raised exactly the issue that we were litigating, at my request, John Roberts conducted a moot court for the counsel for Maine, since a decision favorable to Maine would be favorable to our client. The Supreme Court's decision in Alden focused new attention on federalism and received kudos from many conservatives. Yet at no point during the time that I worked with John Roberts on this issue did I ever hear him voice anything other than his understanding of the governing precedent and his thoughtful and considered views about what arguments appropriately could be made within the existing legal framework. I certainly never saw any signs at all that he viewed the case as an opportunity to promote a conservative ideology or advance a particular political agenda. I believe the qualities that I've admired in John Roberts for the last 15 years are precisely those that qualify him to become the next Chief Justice. The mastery of the law that he exhibited in oral arguments leaves little doubt that he'll be able to find a principled way through the murkiest of constitutional waters. His focus on the facts of the case and the circumstances of his clients suggests that as Chief Justice, he will approach each case on its individual merits. His respect for precedent, with his cautious approach to moving beyond its established bounds, offers reassurance that he will respect the role of stare decisis. And his collegiality and his congeniality will enable him to lead the court as Chief Justice with grace and style. I'd like to make two final points. First, in part because of my experience as a Supreme Court clerk, I have developed tremendous respect for and an appreciation of the role of the court and the role of the rule of law in safeguarding our democracy. As a professor of law, I make it my business now to try and instill that respect in the students I teach. I could not in good conscience come before you today were I not convinced that John Roberts shares that respect and will demonstrate it every day that he serves the court and this nation as Chief Justice. Finally, as both a Democrat and a woman, it's fundamentally important to me that the individual liberties of every citizen, including those relating to the right to privacy and the right to be free from discrimination, be fully protected. I could not be here today if I did not feel confident in trusting my own rights and those of my children and their generation to John Roberts for safekeeping. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bradley. Our next witness is Ms. Anne Marie Tallman, General Counsel of the Mexican Legal Defense and Education Fund, actually President and General Counsel. Prior to taking that position, she had been an executive with Fannie Mae. She began her career with the law firm of Kutak Rock in Denver, a bachelor's degree in psychology and political science from the University of Iowa, and her law degree from Bolt Hall. Thank you for joining us, Ms. Tallman, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for the invitation to testify before you today on the confirmation of John Roberts for the post of Chief Justice of the United States. I'm Anne Marie Tallman, President and General Counsel of MALDEF, the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. We are a nonpartisan civil rights organization established to promote and protect the civil rights of over 40 million Latinos in the area of education, voting rights, immigrants' rights, access to the courts, and employment. It is in these areas that the writings and decisions of Judge Roberts place him in positions opposed not only to equal justice for Latinos, but opposed to the positions taken by bipartisan majorities of this Congress and even by the Reagan administration that he served. There has been much discussion about respect for the law. This hearing is not an abstract discussion. It serves as an acknowledgement of how the law's application impacts all of us, living, working, and contributing to the richness of our country, regardless of our station in life. A Chief Justice must approach his responsibilities with not only an open mind, but cognizant of how his decisions will affect real people. If some of John Roberts' written legal views had been adopted and become settled federal law, thousands of undocumented immigrant children would have effectively been barred from public schools, left largely illiterate and without hope as members of a permanent underclass. A national system of identification cards might be in place, representing an unprecedented intrusion in the privacy rights of Americans and placing minorities at much greater risk of racial profiling and discrimination. An electoral empowerment of Latinos, African Americans, Asian Americans, and Native Americans, and the record number of elected officials of these ancestries in Congress and state and local government nationwide would likely have not been achieved. On immigrants' rights, as special assistant to the Attorney General, he criticized the Supreme Court decision in Plyler v. Doe, a case brought by MALDEF. In Plyler, the court, following two lower courts, struck down a Texas law effectively barring undocumented children from public schools. Roberts criticized the Solicitor General's office for not standing up for what he described as judicial restraint and supporting the state of Texas' arguments against the application of the Equal Protection Clause, an action, he wrote, that could well have altered the outcome of the case. As associate White House counsel, he derided as clinging to symbolism the civil liberties and privacy concerns surrounding national identification cards. In expressing his disagreement with the Reagan administration's opposition to national identifiers, he failed to even mention the potential for discrimination and singling out of Latinos and African Americans. In voting rights, Judge Roberts mischaracterized the bipartisan efforts by members of this committee to restore the effects test to Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act as a radical experiment rather than a restoration of Congress's original purpose. Finally, a Chief Justice must possess an even temperament in fulfilling his duties to dispassionately adjudicate with an open mind. We need men and women on the court who will understand our changing nation. Strikingly, on official White House counsel and Department of Justice memoranda, Judge Roberts displayed a pattern of insensitivity and dismissive comments that show a lack of respect for Latino immigrants, members of Congress who supported equal pay for women, and the history of the Kickapoo Indian tribe. For these reasons, we respectfully urge that you oppose Judge John Roberts' confirmation to serve as Chief Justice of the United States. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Tallman. Our next witness is Judge Denise Posse Blanco Lindbergh, a state court judge in Utah. An immigrant from Cuba, Judge Lindbergh and her family fled Castro, coming here when she was 10 years old. After receiving her bachelor's degree from BYU, she then added three advanced degrees, including a law degree. Among her many accomplishments are clerkship for Justice O'Connor. She worked in the D.C. office of the law firm of Hogan and Hartzell and has been a state court judge in Utah since 1998. Thank you for joining us, Judge Lindbergh. And your testimony begins simultaneously with the rearrival of Senator Hatch.
I wouldn't miss this for the world, I'll tell you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Denise Posse Blanco Lindbergh, and I am a state trial court judge from the state of Utah. I am honored to appear before you today in enthusiastic support for the nomination of Judge John Roberts as Chief Justice of the United States. He brings to this appointment a keen intellect, sound judgment, honesty, fairness, and decency, an exceptional knowledge of and respect for the law, the courts, and our constitutional system. He has all the attributes necessary to be a Chief Justice in the highest traditions of that office. Over the past 15 years, I have observed his career from at least three different vantage points. First, as a law clerk to Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. second as his colleague at the Washington, D.C. law firm of Hogan & Hartson, and as a member of the appellate practice group which he headed, and now as a fellow judge who has reviewed his judicial record. My first exposure to Judge Roberts came on opening day of October term 1990 at the Supreme Court when then Deputy Solicitor General Roberts presented one of the first Monday arguments. I expected a professional presentation from members of the Solicitor General's office, but the skill and effectiveness with which he argued his case far exceeded my expectations. Notwithstanding his youth, his composure, his clear command of the relevant facts and law, and his exceptional ability to engage with the court in a discussion of the issues made a lasting impression on me. After clerking for Justice O'Connor, I joined Hogan's appellate practice group, and I worked with John on a number of cases following his return to the firm. I remember many cases that we worked on, but I specifically remember his support and guidance during my first solo effort at drafting a brief for a case before the D.C. Circuit. It was a pro bono matter, and he willingly spent considerable time reviewing drafts, providing feedback, and that was invariably insightful, helpful, and courteous. He analyzed issues creatively without distorting precedent or stretching a point of law beyond what was permitted by the bounds of law. And on top of that, he was an incredibly nice, genuine human being who was incredibly bright but never arrogant. John's work has always been principled and carefully circumscribed. I learned much of what I know about appellate practice from watching John work and being taught by him. He reveres the law, and he treats it and everyone associated with it with the utmost respect. He has taught, by word and deed, the importance of civility in the practice of law. My final comments come from my perspective as a judge. I've reviewed a substantial number of his body of published opinions and some of the commentary. I have noted at least three problems with some of that commentary. Some commentators have failed to acknowledge that judges do not get to choose the cases that come before them, but must instead respond to the particular facts in light of applicable law. Others overlook the fact that whenever an appellate judge writes for the court, that opinion must also reflect the views of at least one, if not two, other members of the appellate panel. Others appear to misunderstand the essential judicial role. John has correctly noted that judges, quote, do not have a commission to solve society's problems as they see them, but simply to decide cases and before them according to the rule of law. In each opinion that I reviewed, John focused on the case before him, did not overreach, or did not use it as a vehicle to further any personal preferences. He was respectful of precedent. In fact, he demonstrated the very kind of judicial restraint that this body has indicated is an important consideration for any nominee to the court. To this high office, John brings a remarkable combination of skills, personality, and respect for constitutional principles that will make him a highly effective Chief Justice. His towering intellectual skills and engaging personality will enable John to work effectively with his colleagues and bring consensus to a divided court. Those same traits will make him an outstanding leader of the federal judiciary and will allow him to work very cooperatively with the coordinate branches of government. I respectfully urge this committee to recommend to the full Senate swift confirmation of Judge John Roberts as Chief Justice of the United States. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Judge Lindberg. Our final witness on the panel is Mr. Reginald Turner, President of the National Bar Association, the nation's oldest and largest association of African-American lawyers. Member of the Detroit-based law firm of Clark Hill, had been a White House fellow and worked as an aide to former HUD Secretaries Cisneros and Cuomo. A law degree from the University of Michigan and an undergraduate degree from Wayne State University. We appreciate your being here, Mr. Turner, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. To Chairman Spector and to all of the members of the committee, the National Bar Association appreciates this opportunity to address you on behalf of the network of over 20,000 lawyers of color who are members of the National Bar Association and on behalf of our 80 affiliates across the nation and around the world. Here with me today is the chair of the National Bar Association's Judicial Selection Committee, Assistant Dean Alfreda Robinson from the George Washington University School of Law, who has worked tirelessly to prepare us for this moment. We're also joined by Theodore Shaw, the Director Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, whose efforts have contributed to the advancement of civil rights and civil liberties for well over a decade. The significance of the confirmation of a Chief Justice of the United States cannot be overstated. We ask this committee to ensure that any nominee is extraordinarily qualified before giving this esteemed position. The National Bar Association has established a fair process and fair criteria for evaluating judicial nominees. We take a position on a nomination only after a complete and exhaustive review of the nominee's record. We've reviewed Judge Roberts' entire record, including his professional and educational background and the available records of his years as a government lawyer. The record is, unfortunately, complex and troubling. It's also incomplete. Judge Roberts has impressive educational credentials and a distinguished employment history, but these credentials alone are not sufficient to qualify a lawyer or judge to be Chief Justice of the United States. Sadly, this nation was founded on principles and laws that denied many rights and privileges, including the right to vote and of citizenship, to African Americans and women. Throughout our history, however, the Supreme Court has helped to advance our nation toward the ideal of equal justice under law. And the effect of that work on African Americans is perhaps unduplicated with respect to any other people in the United States. Many of the cases in which the Supreme Court has advanced equal justice under law have been decided by razor-thin margins, most typically 5-4. Accordingly, the stakes in this appointment could not be higher. As the Honorable Senator Edward Kennedy stated earlier during this hearing, the devastation of Hurricane Katrina has exposed America's continued racial inequities and economic disparities. In this country, race and treatment of racial issues by the judiciary profoundly affect every aspect of American life and play critical roles in the formulation of American social, economic, and political agendas. Accordingly, the National Bar Association must determine whether a federal judicial nominee will interpret the Constitution and laws to effectuate racial equality and eliminate oppression. Despite the claims of neutrality and equality, our legal system is not yet as colorblind as it should be. In Grutter versus Bollinger, which upheld the use of affirmative action, Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor acknowledged that. She said, and I quote, "In a society like our own, race, unfortunately, still matters. Therefore, a judicial nominee's record should demonstrate support for constitutional principles, statutes, and legal doctrines that serve to extend the blessings of liberty to all Americans, including people of color." Unfortunately, the available record on Judge Roberts precludes us from supporting his nomination. We take the position on the following grounds. The record is incomplete, as many important documents have been withheld from this committee and from the public. There are numerous available documents demonstrating that the nominee does not support civil rights, civil liberties, and equal justice under law. He's argued for the use of inordinately restrictive standing analysis to limit access for groups seeking to promote civil rights and civil liberties. He's argued for reducing the authority of federal courts even to hear cases relating to civil rights and civil liberties. And he's argued for a restriction of the federal court's ability to remedy those violations. In conclusion, on the basis of our thorough review of the available record on Judge Roberts, and for the reasons cited above, the National Bar Association cannot support this confirmation. Earlier, there was a reference to memoranda. It's really important to note that those memoranda, reflecting Judge Roberts' views, which have not been repudiated during the course of these hearings, must be considered by this committee as reflecting his current views. We thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. A vote has been called, and we're in the latter stages of it. There are a great many questions which we could benefit from on dialogue. As I had said earlier, we have invited 30 witnesses. We had many, many, many requests, and we accommodated as many as we could, but it realistically precludes very much by way of questioning. We have a Utah judge here. Senator Hatch, do you have a comment or two?
I do, as a matter of fact. I just want to thank you all for appearing.
Orrin Hatch, Republican of Utah.
A little bit about my good friend and Utah judge here. Judge Lindbergh, given your unique and impressive personal, academic, and legal background, I think you're in a strong position to offer an opinion on Judge Roberts. Not only did you serve there at that law firm, but you have one of the strongest backgrounds of any woman lawyer in this country. As a woman with a Puerto Rican mother and a Cuban father who fled Cuba as a young child and then went on to a distinguished academic career, earning 2 master's degrees and a Ph.D., and then went on to the Brigham Young University School of Law and got a law degree there with honors, and then knowing something of the Supreme Court from the inside from your times that you spent as a law clerk to Sandra Day O'Connor, and then working at the highest levels of the legal profession, including your work as, like I've mentioned, as a colleague of Judge Roberts of the law firm of Hogan and Hartson, and now having spent the last 7 years on the bench yourself in one of Utah's trial courts, very, very pleased to have you here. And I was particularly pleased to listen to your experiences as a woman, as a minority, as an able jurist, in that you believe Judge Roberts' qualifications to be as good as anybody could possibly have. That means a lot to me, and I personally want to pay tribute to you as somebody who has not only excelled in the legal profession, but deserves the accolades that I've just given. But thank you for coming. I appreciate you being here, and I appreciate all of you and your testimonies, whether or not we agree or disagree. We appreciate that you've taken time to come and discuss these matters with us.
Thank you, Senator Hatch. Senator Kennedy?
Just briefly, and thank you.
Edward Tolman, Kennedy, Democrat of Massachusetts.
What kind of America would we be if the judge's position on the Plyler case had been the findings and we had that kind of education policy to many Hispanic families?
The Plyler decision was a very important piece of litigation decided before the United States Supreme Court that has profound impacts on the ability of undocumented immigrant children who are in this country by no fault of their own, and the ability of them to be protected under the Constitution, upholding over 100 years of jurisprudence that prove that aliens were persons under the Constitution, and that education was something that these children should be able to access. If that decision had been decided differently, because judicial restraint pursuant to Judge Roberts' view would have been followed, the Equal Protection Clause may not have been applied in that case, and as a result, we would have a permanent underclass of children in this country who would be unable to access public education.
And your response to his position, well, that was the position of the administration, and he was just carrying forward what the administration's policy. Did you find out? I asked him about the great decision that Justice Warren, the great Brown decision, he said was settled law with regards to black children. Did you find somewhat troublesome that he had different interpretation when it came to children of Hispanics?
I think the concerns that we have on Plyler is that on the memo that he wrote on the day of the decision on June of 1982, his instant reaction was to ignore the Supreme Court's rationale regarding the important societal impact of the decision and focus on how it would have resulted in potentially a different outcome had judicial restraint been followed. That's his personal view, that he thought judicial restraint should have been or could have been followed had the Solicitor General's office followed a different approach. And I think that with his ongoing perspectives of the limited involvement of the federal government in the protection of people's civil rights, I believe that Judge Roberts' views are that limited involvement, no remarks during this hearing to state that he feels strongly about the decision in Plyler, and his memo on the day of the decision all raise very serious concerns for us.
Carol Browner, let me just ask you about the judge's 1983 position about the non-delegation doctrine, the constitutional anomaly of independent agencies. This is the recognition, it's the unified presidency, meaning that these independent agencies really don't have the authority to carry. If we carried that concept through to its logical end, where would we be, for example, on environmental issues, just generally on clean air, clean water?
I think we'd be in complete disarray,
former
and
the amount of protections we have been able to
provide to date probably wouldn't be there. I mean, Congress has very wisely delegated to the Environmental Protection Agency the difficult work of making sure that all the science is there before a pollution standard is set, making sure that both industry and the public at large get to comment on this. And there's a whole process that unfolds. If Congress were not able to delegate that authority to the executive branch, to the independent agencies, I suspect that either nothing would happen or it would happen much more slowly because Congress would be left to do that. We made a decision when I was in the administration to set tough public health air pollution standards for ozone and fine particles, sometimes referred to as soot and smog. These are standards that will prevent tens of thousands of premature deaths. They are very important. A lower court found that that was an unconstitutional provision of the Clean Air Act. In the Supreme Court, we did win 9-0, but it is important to protect that going forward.
My time is just about up, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator Kennedy. Thank you all. The time has expired, so we're going to go to vote. There may be two votes, but we'll be back as promptly as we can to proceed with Panel 3. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you, members of the committee.
Well, that was Panel 3. He means that they'll go back and we'll be addressing Panel 4 when they return. This Senator Arlen Specter, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, wrapping up this third panel of outside witnesses to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee today, following the testimony of Judge John Roberts, who wrapped up his sessions with the Judiciary Committee early this morning. Well, not that early this morning, about 11 o'clock this morning. And, of course, that means an end to his testimony. There was also, of course, a brief meeting afterwards where this is normal activity for the past several years of nominees to the federal bench are hold a private meeting with the Judiciary Committee where they go over any questions that may have been raised by FBI background investigations. Indeed, if there were any questions, the brevity of the interview with John Roberts on this case suggests if there were any questions, they were not substantive. And indeed, that's what both Senators Leahy and Specter said afterwards after they emerged, that there was nothing substantive to emerge from that. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg is here with me in the Hart Senate office building as we take another break, this time for senators go vote.
I don't even know what they're voting on, Neil. Maybe somebody here can find out and tell us. It would just be sort of interesting for folks to know that. But I wanted to raise a subject that came up at the end of Judge Roberts' testimony and that you heard echoed by at least some of these witnesses, the head of the Mexican-American Legal Defense Fund.
Mm-hmm.
There's great concern about this decision, the Plyler decision from the early 80s when the Supreme Court ruled by a 5-4 vote with Justice Lewis Powell, a Nixon appointee, casting the decisive vote, I guess.
And again, this was the Texas law.